Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Welcome to Administrative Static. Great to have you with us today. And the lead-in is a little bit misleading today because John Vecchione is on business travel. And so we have guest hosting today, my colleague, Harriet Hageman. Harriet, great to have you with us today. I think you're going to kick us off with our first segment. So I'll just hand it over to you.
Thank you, Mark. It's wonderful to be here. And I appreciate the opportunity to visit with your audience today. I have with me Caleb Krockenberg, who is one of our attorneys here at NCLA, and Caleb has been working on a variety of very interesting cases that I think the audience will be interested in learning more about. Welcome, Caleb.
Thank you.
First of all, I'd like to discuss with you some of the work that you've been doing on two related cases. One of the cases is called Apoushian, and another case is called Cargill. And both of these lawsuits challenge the ATF's decision to designate bump stocks as a machine gun. And rather than me talking about all of that, I would first like to have you explain a little bit about what is a bump stock and why did the ATF do what it did?
Yeah, well, you know, this has been an issue that's now been going on for a while. This started in actually December of 2018, at the very end of 2018. But the ATF made a decision to reclassify bump stocks as machine guns. And a bump stock, for those of you who don't know, is basically just a piece of plastic. It's an accessory that fits over a normal semi-automatic rifle. And it basically allows the weapon to slide back and forth. And for skilled shooters, they can use that device to use a technique called bump firing, where they basically pull the trigger really quickly. And it looks like you're shooting really fast with a semi-automatic rifle. And
what about unskilled shooters, Caleb? Can any person just put a bump stock on a rifle and suddenly become able to shoot it like a machine gun?
Well, no. And you know, our clients, and I'll talk about our clients, but Clark Apoushian of Apoushian versus ATF, he's a shooting instructor, and he took me to the gun range to show me the bump stock and how to fire it. And he's a professional instructor, and it took him probably 10 tries to get it to work. It's actually a technique, and what's interesting is that people can do it with practice without a bump stock. They can just do it by holding a firearm loosely in their hands. But you all probably remember back in November of, I believe, 2017, there was a mass shooting in Las Vegas. And
yeah, I think it was October 1st, if I remember right, 2017.
And I think that's right. And unfortunately, that tragedy appears to have involved bump stocks. It seems like had used bump stocks on some of his weapons. And because of that, and because of the political fallout of that event, there was an effort in Congress to try to make bump stocks into prohibited items, because the ATF actually had said for years, these are not machine guns, they're not prohibited items, they're not even weapons at all, they're just accessories. But, you know, people didn't really like that politically. And so, you know, there was an effort in Congress to try to change the law and make these prohibited items. And the ATF got involved and it said, basically, you know what? No reason at all to change the law. We'll just change it for you. And so they issued a regulation that said these are now machine guns. We were wrong to say otherwise.
Did they issue a regulation or another type of announcement?
No, so they issued a regulation.
Okay.
And they said, this is a final rule. We are changing the definition of a machine gun. And they added a line into the definition saying that bump stocks are now machine guns. If you possess them, it's a federal crime, punishable by up to 10 years in prison for a first-time offender.
Well, and how many bump stocks were out there at the time that this pronouncement was made?
So when this came out, the ATF itself estimated that about 500,000 of these had been sold lawfully. And I mean that, so our client, Clark Pogian, when he bought one of these devices, it actually came with a laminated letter from the ATF to the company saying, this is not a machine gun, it's not a prohibited item. So he bought it with the ATF's explicit blessing. And then the ATF turned around and said, actually, never mind. It's now a federal crime to do what we said you could do.
And what did they require the owners of bump stocks to do at that point?
Well, so they either had to destroy them or turn them into the ATF by the end of the year. So this came out in December of 2018. They said, you have to do this by I think, January 31st of 2019. And if not, we're going to come prosecute you. We're going to send you to prison.
And they would have known where the people were who owned the bump stocks, weren't they? Because they were distributed with these certificates saying that they were not machine guns and that they were legal.
Yeah. And I mean, people use them at shooting ranges. And, you know, there are several manufacturers, right? These are legitimate companies selling these devices nationwide.
Had there ever been a determination made by ATF as to an official determination as to whether a bump stock mechanism could be considered a machine gun? Had they actually made an affirmative finding in that regard?
Yeah, they said over and over again, it's not. And the way the ATF works is they can examine devices. So you can send your device to the ATF and you say, hey, is this a regulated item? Give me a ruling on that. And the bump stock manufacturers all did that. And the ATF said repeatedly, yeah, it's fine. It's not a device because it doesn't actually change the way a gun fires. And that's really the important point. For bump stock, you have to pull the trigger every single time a bullet is fired from the gun. And that's different than a machine gun where you just hold the trigger down.
And why is that significant in terms of the rules or the statutory provisions that apply?
Well, so when Congress decided what's a machine gun, what's not, the line they drew is how the trigger works. A machine gun, like we would all imagine, is if you pull the trigger and hold it down, it just keeps firing. That's a machine gun. But if it just fires one bullet every time you pull the trigger or engage the trigger, it's not. And a bump stock doesn't change the way the trigger works.
It changed the mechanism by which you hold the gun itself. Isn't that right?
Basically.
Okay. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about Pogian and about that lawsuit and where it is right now, the status of that.
Can I make a special request that we could have Caleb come back to talk about Pogian when he's closer to filing the cert petition at the Supreme Court? But I'd really like to hear about the Cargill case since he just filed the motion for summary judgment in that case. It was a reply brief. I take it back.
Yeah, so we filed two cases, Pogian and Cargill. And in Cargill, we filed that in Texas. And we went to trial. There were a number of challenges to this rule across the country. And we were the first ones to actually take it all the way to a trial in front of a federal judge. And we presented evidence. And unfortunately, our trial judge ruled against us, but we appealed to the Fifth Circuit. And we have just now completed briefing. And we hope to have oral argument here in, you know, a month or so. And I think this really is poised to be a case that is going to strike down the bump stock rule nationwide and permanently because, the government has sort of very weakly tried to suggest, they're like, well, it's not really that important what we're doing. We're not really changing anything. And sort of bizarrely, they've taken the position now that bump stocks have always been machine guns. The agency was just wrong in the beginning. The old ATF didn't know what it was doing, basically. And so it's a very weak defense by the government.
Well, and where do you anticipate this going with Cargill in the Fifth Circuit?
Well, I think, I am very optimistic that we're going to be successful in the Fifth Circuit. But as I said, there's other cases out there. And the Pogian case is one. I think the courts are ultimately going to be split on this. And I think what's going to happen is this United States Supreme Court is going to have to grant review of one or more of these cases.
Why is this case so important to NCLA? What are some of the legal and administrative issues that we have been focusing on, both in the Apogean and Cargill cases?
Well, this is about who makes the law, really. And this is not a gun case. I tell people all the time, and they're a little confused by it. It's about who gets to make crimes, who gets to tell people that they can, you know, the government can send them to prison for doing something. Here it's pretty clear that Congress wrote a law that said bump stocks are not machine guns. Not a crime to own one. ATF disagreed, and now we have a prosecutor, a prosecutorial agency that's part of the Department of Justice, saying, you know what, we can change the criminal law, and then we can prosecute people and send them to prison for breaking the law that we made up. And that's not the way the government is supposed to work. And really, this case is just about that. It's about who gets to send people to prison.
It really comes down to whether we are a republic and a representative form of government, and our congressional representatives are the ones making the law, or as in this circumstance with ATF literally coming in and saying one thing for decades in terms of what is a machine gun and what is a bump stock, and a bump stock is not a machine gun, and then after a situation coming in and saying, yeah, we change our mind, and we're going to declare that they're not, that they are machine guns, and that all of you who own them are criminals and will be designated a criminal within 3 weeks or whatever the amount of time was.
Yeah, and really outrageous here is that the agency shut down the democratic process. I mean, what we want is if the government thinks that bump stocks should be illegal, if our representatives do, they should change the law. And if we don't like it as voters, we can vote them out. We can hold them accountable. But when the ATF came in and they said, you know, we're going to make that tough decision for you, well, then Congress just shut down. They did all these bills that they had proposed. They all died. They didn't go anywhere because they don't have to be accountable for the party.
And that's the fundamental issue.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. Delighted that our colleague Caleb Kruckenberg is able to stick with us for another segment, because there's another case that Caleb has been working on for the New Civil Liberties Alliance that actually I think it was the very first case that NCLA filed, if I'm not mistaken, Caleb. Is that right?
I believe it was, yes.
Yeah. And so, and this was back in the fall or maybe late summer of, I think, fall of 2018. Against the city of Coral Gables, Florida, over their automatic license plate readers. And that case has been going, I mean, we're coming up on 3 years since you first filed the case, and we're still in the trial court. It feels like it's been going like molasses. I suppose that COVID is part of the reason for the slowdown, but could you just quickly bring our audience up to speed on what has happened in that case so far from a procedural standpoint and where it stands now?
Well, we're coming to the end of it, and I'm optimistic about that. We actually just this week filed our motions for summary judgment, and we're pretty optimistic that we're going to get a final ruling that's going to dispose of this case based on the motions for summary judgment. And you know, we've kind of been stuck in discovery for a long time, and COVID obviously complicated things a little bit, but you know, it's been interesting. We've gathered a ton of information about the way Coral Gables has been using their automatic license plate reading cameras, the kind of data they're gathering. And, you know, it really paints a disturbing picture about surveillance and police access to our information.
Absolutely. What's maybe one fact you've learned that particularly troubles you? I know there was something that jumped out at me, but
yeah. Well, so just kind of by way of background, the city has this camera system of automatic license plate reading cameras that operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and they take a picture of every license plate that's in camera range.
And if you're speeding or if you go through a red light, I mean, you've done something wrong when they take your picture?
No, if you just drive on the road. They take it.
Just driving on the road. They just snap a picture of your license plate. Every car that goes by.
Exactly. And they're actually specially designed to be able to take an image every 0.6 seconds. So it's every single car that goes by. And what the city did is they set up a system strategically around the entire city at every major intersection. And keep in mind, Coral Gables is about 13 square miles. So
yeah, I think it's 50,000 people or something. So not huge.
In that area, they have 18 cameras set up, or at 18 locations. And as we learned in Discovery, in a 3-year period, they collected over 106 million individual images of people's license plates.
Wow. Yeah, that was the thing that jumped out at me. 106 million. Isn't that unbelievable, Harriet?
Yeah, why?
Well, and they did it, they say, because they want to create a quote-unquote geofence around the city where they can keep track of everyone who goes in and out of
the
city. That's what they said it was for. And the idea is that they're going to somehow be able to solve crimes. But what they
I assume they've solved some major crimes in the last three or four years that they've had this system in effect then?
Another thing we learned in Discovery is that they attribute 6 crimes to have been successfully solved because of the 106 million images they've collected. And I'll give you some examples of the major crimes that we're talking about.
They've really cracked some tough nuts with this system.
Theft of used cooking oil.
Oh my goodness.
Another one was the most serious was the use of a credit card skimmer. And then a stolen car. And there were 2 others. I think somebody broke into a car and another property crime.
Are they saying they couldn't have solved these crimes without the camera system?
Yeah, they're attributing the license plate reading cameras to being able to, because what they could do for the theft of used cooking oil, for example, they got an image of a van and then they tracked it every time it was in the city, and they were able to realize that it had stolen cooking oil from several other restaurants. So that's how they cracked that case.
Hasn't the Supreme Court ruled on something similar to that already?
Well, and that's the issue. As scary as the number 106 million images is, what's really scary is the city keeps them. And they give them to law enforcement. And a law enforcement officer can just kind of just poke around. And just to see where people have been, and they can look and they can run a particular license plate number and say, all right, this is every single place this car has been in the city in the last 3 years, and give the specific time, date, and location. And then they can just look up the DMV information and find out who you are, and your home phone number, and your social security number, your picture, everything.
Serious surveillance.
It is. And the United States Supreme Court, in a case called Carpenter versus United States, said that in a similar context where law enforcement gathers your cell phone location information, which, as we all probably know, when you have your cell phone, it pings the cell tower and the cell company has a record of where you are, like, all the time. The Supreme Court said, well, police can't access that information, figure out where you are without a warrant. They have to have a good reason to think you're committing a crime. And it's really no different with the license plate readers, because the police can look where you've been for 3 years and say, like, he was at church, he went to the gym, whatever.
When you connect that license plate to the camera, you've created the same kind of information.
Exactly. And so we sued, and our request is pretty simple. We just want the same rule. We want the courts to say it is not okay to give this information to law enforcement unless the law enforcement has a warrant. You can't just store it forever. You can't just have the police just checking up just in case they're curious.
And in other contexts, the Supreme Court has said that keeping something even a year is too long. Or was that the Florida Supreme Court or the U.S. Supreme Court that had that?
The Florida Supreme Court has gone even farther. They've said, in some instances, we think keeping information for a year is too long. We think in some cases collecting data location for a single day is too much without a warrant. And there's a case in the Florida Courts of Appeals where law enforcement got cell tower locations for a 6-hour period for one person. They put them at three different locations in over the course of 6 hours. And the court said, no, you have to get a warrant for that information.
Well, and why don't they want to get a warrant for that information?
Well, because they have a lot of excuses.
Well, there's no probable cause, right?
There's no probable cause. And one of the things we got, we asked for the records of our client in discovery. And they gave us these, you know, pages of documents. And you can look through. You can look through individual days. You know, I can tell you on July 4th, 2018, for example, I can tell you when my client went to the gym and when he left. Because there's a photograph of it. And, you know, that's
right. It's not just a photograph of the license plate. It's a photograph of the occupant as well, many times, right?
Because with his dog. And the dog
hanging out the window.
So it's, you know, it is incredibly invasive.
It is Big Brother at its worst.
And our client hasn't done anything wrong. He just does not believe that the police have any right to just spy on its citizenry for no good reason.
And that is
functionally, it's not a lot different than facial recognition technology, because you have the picture of the person and you have their license plate and that tells you who the person is. So it may not be 100% identity, because, you know, my wife might drive my car or vice versa or whatever, but it's going to tell you 99% of the time who that picture that you know, who that is in the picture you just took.
Well, it has your home address, your telephone number, you know, I mean, that, because what the police can do is they run your license plate and it just pops up a picture of your driver's license with your insurance information, your criminal record, your driving history, everything. And it really is. It can be, you know, just if they're curious. And we ask the police, what are the rules? What are your limits on when police can do this? And they said, we don't really have any. It just has to be the police doing an investigation.
So,
didn't the U.S. Supreme Court put out a case just earlier this week, Caleb, that was relevant here? I think it refused to find criminal liability for a police officer who, it wasn't this particular system, but who was looking in a computer system in a way that he wasn't authorized to do.
That's right. I mean, even if there were limits, right, even if the department had its own limits on when police could do this, the city has reassured us time and again. They're saying, we're only going to use this appropriately. Don't worry about it.
What does that mean?
What is it? But one of the things we learned is that actually, they've disciplined several police officers in the last few years for misusing their system, for running non-law enforcement searches. And as you said, in the Supreme Court this week, there was a major case that said that you can't criminally prosecute police officers for misusing their access in cases like this. It was actually almost identical. It was
so we have a serious catch-22.
Yeah, he ran a license plate search when he wasn't supposed to, I think, or a personal friend or something. And there's no criminal liability there. And I think what's concerning is there are no guardrails. Unless you have a warrant requirement, unless you have some sort of court oversight, you know, you really just have to trust the police aren't going to abuse a system like this.
So what's the particular question that Judge Sinnemann will be answering in ruling on the motion for summary judgment?
Well, the particular question is whether a system like this that has no constitutional limits, that has no limits on how the police can use the information or store the information, is acceptable under either the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution or a similar provision in the Florida Constitution. And really what we're asking for is a ruling that says that the police have to get a warrant. They can still use information like this, and perhaps they can store it for limited periods of time, but they cannot just gather this kind of data and just cast about blindly just in case they can come across evidence of a crime.
That's right. And the other thing that we've said is that, look, it's perfectly fine if they have a database of Amber Alerts or stolen plates or whatever, and they want to use these automatic license plate readers to identify those. And when they get a hit, they can pull those, you know, those folks over. But you can't take all of these hundreds of millions of photos of innocent drivers and just store them in the database in case they might be handy down the road. That's a severe violation of the Fourth Amendment. And Caleb, thank you for being with us. Glad that you're on the case, because I'm optimistic about how this one's going to turn out. We'll see.
Thank you.